This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. For most artists, it would be enough to have one signature hit, one all-time great, like this one. I don't like you, but I love you. Seems that I'm always thinking of you, though you treat me badly. I love And if you didn't just sing it, you also wrote and produced it. I mean, that would be pretty extraordinary. In this case, for that song, the extraordinary talent in question is, of course, Smokey Robinson, the former frontman of the Miracles and Motown legend, who is my guest this week. And Smokey didn't just write, record, and produce one all-time great hit song. He is responsible for a pile of the greatest pop hits of the 20th century. Tears of a Clown. Like a clown, I pretend to be glad. Now there's some sad things known to man, but ain't too much sadder than the tears of a clown when there's no one around. I second that emotion. Cruising. Literally dozens more. Smokey Robinson is now 83 years old. He is still recording, still writing. Earlier this year, he released a new album, Gasms. Yes, that's the title. And yes, it is about what that title would suggest, sex. And we should be clear that we will talk a little bit about sex and use some sexual terminology in this interview. So if you or someone you're listening with is sensitive to that kind of thing, there's your warning. For everyone else, honestly, I bet you can't wait to hear Smokey Robinson talk about all that and about a lot more. So let's get into it. Here's the single from Gasms, The Way You Make Me Feel.
You make me feel like everything's okay.
Smokey Robinson, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thank you very much.
And congratulations on this very horny new album.
All right. That's a good description. Thank you.
Did you have like a list of types of records you could make? And one said like a dance record. One said, and then just one of them said, horny record, question mark, like on a whiteboard in your office.
No, I did not have a list. I guess the only thought there was the horny one. Yeah, I didn't have a list.
Was it a goal to make something that was that was not what people might expect from you?
Yeah, it was. I wanted to be controversial. I wanted to get that attention from the first drop. You know, people hear that word gasms. And normally when you hear gasms, the first thought that comes to your mind is orgasm, you know.
So I sort of, for yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
Smokey. I would never think of something that dirty.
I know you wouldn't, but I'm just about the average person.
I'm a public radio host, yeah, sir.
Exactly. You know, how dare I say something
I've never
like
known
that.
The touch of a woman.
But anyway, yeah, I wanted the controversy and see when people, when they hear it, they're going to know that gasms is any good feeling you might have. You know, I looked it up before I continued with writing the song. I started writing the song and I said, wait a minute, I better check this out for myself. So I looked up the word and it was cool. But now it gives people a chance to make up their own minds as to what their gasm is when they hear it.
Now, I'm so grateful to have you here. And, you know, I heard your publicist discussing your schedule, getting out to promote this record. And the thought that I had was, look, you're in front of me with your leg crossed. You are lithe and healthy, but you don't have to be working this hard. So why are you?
Because I love my job. You know, I tried retiring at one point in my life. And maybe when I tried the retirement, I was too young to even think about retiring at that point. But I was just retiring from the outer edges of show business, from being on stage and performing and doing those things like that, or recording and all that, because I was vice president of Motown. And I figured I'd just do that for the rest of my life, you know, just because I had been on the road, man, since I was 16 with the Miracles, you know, and we had done everything a group could possibly do. Two or three times, and we've been all over the world and all that. And when we first started out, there was a girl in the group who was my ex-wife, Claudette. In fact, today is her birthday. and so she was in the group. And after a couple of years or so of marriage, we decided we want to have some babies. And we had 7 miscarriages due to the fact that she was on the road, and the road is hard, you know. So anyway, she came off the road and blah, blah, blah. And we finally had my oldest son and my daughter. And when my kids were born, man, that really was a trigger for me. I just wanted to, hey, I want to be with my kids, you know, and I got a job, you know, it's not like that. So I told the guys I was going to retire. And they laughed at me because, you know, we'd been together since we were like 11 years old. We grew up together and all that. So they laughed at me because they knew how much I loved show business, how much I love being with them on stage and all that, you know. So they just laughed at me and left. So anyway, and then prior to that time, in 1967, man, Stevie Wonder had given me a track. And he came, we used to have Motown Christmas parties annually every year. And all the artists were there. And so Stevie comes up to me, he says, hey, man, I got this music on this track. And it's a great track. He said, I just recorded this track. It's a great track, but I can't think of a song to go with this track. So why don't you listen to see what you can come up with? I said, okay, man. So he gave it to me. So I took it home and I listened to it. And the first thing that I heard, or the intro, was bum, 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 ba-da-dun, dun, 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 which is Ringling Brothers. That's Barnum and Bailey, baby. You know, so I said, okay, I'm going to write something about the circus for this track, you know. And then I thought about it. I said, well, the circus, you know, if I'm going to write about the circus, I want to write something that's personal, something that's, you know, like heart-wrenching or something. And so I thought about it. And when I was a kid, when I was in elementary school, one of our teachers told the story of Pagliacci. And till this moment, right now, I don't know if Pagliacci was real or if he was just mythical. But anyway, the story of Pagliacci. Pagliacci was the Italian clown who was the headliner of the circus. People came to the circus to see Pagliacci. The animals and the tightrope walkers and all those people, everything was secondary to Pagliacci. They loved Pagliacci. And when he came on, they roared and they screamed and they, you know, more and more, everything. So he was the man. He went back to his dressing room and he cried because he didn't have that kind of admiration from a woman. You know, he was womanless. So I said, okay, I'm going to write about Pagliacci, but I'm going to make it personal.
Down to fooling you. Now, honey, that's quite a different
So Tears of a Clown, we put it on this album in 1967. And in 1970, a young lady who worked for Motown in England was listening to that album. And that cut came on. And there was a guy named Peter who ran the office in England at the time. And she said, "Peter, I want you to hear this song." So they heard Tears of a Clown. And they put it out in England. Now, Motown, we had never had a number one record in England ever. The record goes up and goes to number one. So then it starts to spread out all over the world. I had another record ready to come out in the States. And Barry said, no, man. We're going to put out Tears of a Clown, which we did. To this day, Tears of a Clown is the biggest selling single I've ever been connected to. Okay? It was just all over the world, you know. So the guys came to me and said, "Hey, man, you are definitely not retiring now, you know, because we got the best record we ever had, blah, blah, blah. Our money is going to soar," which it did, you know, blah. So I said, "Okay, I'll go for another year," which I did. I went for another year, and then I retired. And I just would go to the office every day, and I was, you know, doing my vice president thing. And it was great at first, man, because it was a change. And I was going there, and when I was in Detroit, my office was originally designed to induct new talent. And that's what I did in Detroit, you know. Move out to L.A., and Barry tells me, he says, "Okay, man," he said, "you're my best friend. I trust you more than anybody. You're going to be the financial office. All the checks are going to come to you. You're going to sign all the payroll checks, with the exception of the payment for the records. That's going to go through the sales like it always is." This is great, man. So you should see my signature now.
I mean, that's our dream. That's everyone's dream, Smokey, is to sign payroll checks. Like, finally, I don't have to play arenas anymore. Yeah, I can back to the...
Exactly, man. Because my kids were babies, man, and I would go home every day and see them, you know. And I'm doing that. And after about 2.5 years, I found myself miserable. I was absolutely miserable. But I'm hiding it. And I'm not going to show it to my wife because she's going to say, "Well, golly, you just came off the road. You're here with us and the kids and the blah, blah, blah. And you see us every day and so on." And she would be disappointed. I'm not going to tell Barry because he's my best friend. He trusts me to do this job and all that, you know. So I'm not going to tell him. I'm not going to tell anybody. I'm just going to suffer in silence, you know. And I think that's what I'm doing. And one day, after about 3 years or so, Barry came to my office. And he said, "Hey, man," he said, "I want you to do something for me." I said, "What, man?" I'm thinking he's going to tell me something corporate. "Let's go have a meeting with so on and so forth. Or go try to get this published," because I bought some publishing companies and stuff like that to merge them in. Go do something like that. He sits down. He says, "Sit down, man." I sat down. He said, "I need you to do something." I said, "What?" He said to me, he said, "I want you to get a band. And I want you to go in the studio and make a record. And I want you to get the F out of here." I said, "What, man? What'd you say to me?" He said, "You heard me, man. I said, I want you to get a band. I want you to go in the studio and make a record. I want you to get the F out of here." I said, "What are you talking about, man?" He said, "Man, I see you coming in here every day and you're miserable." He said, "You think you're hiding it from me, but you're my best friend. I know you, man." He said, "You are miserable. And when I see you miserable, it makes me miserable. And I don't want to be miserable. So I need you to get the F out of my face." So I just hugged him, man. Because it was a godsend. It was a god day. Because I wanted so bad. Before that day, I would go to little clubs, man, and see anybody, just to see somebody on stage. I was suffering, and I didn't want anybody to know it, but he knew it, you know. So I was very happy, man. I went home and I wrote a song with my sister, Quiet Storm, and I recorded a Quiet Storm album, and it, you know. It was my debut back into show business and back into doing what I love. And with the feeling that I got from not doing it, I don't want that feeling anymore. So I'm going to be the George Burns of this end of show business, man, because I can't find anything that I love like this.
We've got so much more to get into with the great Smokey Robinson. When we come back from a break, we will talk about one of his greatest influences, the legendary Jackie Wilson. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org. And NPR.
This message comes from Capital One, presenting sponsor of the 2024 Tiny Desk Contest. Nearly 7,000 unsigned artists entered the Tiny Desk Contest this year, The judges picked one winner to perform behind the tiny desk at NPR's headquarters. And now NPR Music is teaming up with NPR member stations to take the show across the country. Join the fun as the winner travels to 10 cities this summer, including Los Angeles, Brooklyn, and Chicago, for one-of-a-kind concerts with Tiny Desk Contest artists from each location. Visit tinydeskcontest.npr.org to meet the winner and buy tickets. Then check out the Capital One Venture X card. Earn unlimited 2X miles on everything you buy. Plus, get access to a $300 annual credit for bookings through Capital One Travel. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MassMutual. According to calendar.com, the average person schedules just 4.5 hours per year on finances. MassMutual gets it. Life is busy. If you can't find time to plan your financial future, find someone who can, like a MassMutual financial professional. For the last 170 years, they've helped people plan for retirement, college tuition, and any other short or long-term financial goals. Learn more at MassMutual.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's teladochealth/whatsyourwhy. Support for NPR and the following message come from the Lemelson Foundation, dedicated to improving lives through invention, innovation, and climate action.
Hi, everyone. I'm Laura House.
And I'm Annabelle Gurwitch. And sometimes it feels like the whole world is a dumpster fire.
Right? There's too much to worry about.
That's why we make Tiny Victories. It's a 15-minute podcast where we celebrate our minor accomplishments and fleeting joys.
And listeners call in, like Valerie, who found the perfect gift for her daughter's boyfriend, and Adam, who finally turned his couch cushion the right way.
And little happinesses, like how birdsong helps your brain.
That's science. So join us in Not Freaking Out for 15 minutes a week.
That's Tiny Victories with Annabelle and Laura, Mondays on Maximum Fun.
Whew, it's a tiny victory just to make a network promo.
Honestly.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Smokey Robinson. He was, of course, the frontman of The Miracles, a legendary singer, songwriter, and producer. I mean, look, the word legendary is a cliche, but I can't come up with a better one for Smokey Robinson. This is the man behind Tears of a Clown, I Second That Emotion, and many, 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 many more. His new album came out earlier this year. It's a concept record about love and intimacy called Gasms. Let's get back into my conversation with Smokey Robinson. It took me a long time after I had kids to feel like I felt comfortable slowing down to their speed.
Yeah.
Like I was, because among other things, like having kids makes you feel scared if you're the breadwinner in your family.
Yeah.
It makes you feel scared that you're not going to be able to put the pieces together right to support your family and blah, 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 blah. But that energy, that like drive forward is in opposition to sitting on the floor and putting blocks together with somebody.
Yeah, I was more afraid that my kids wouldn't know me, man. See, I was more afraid of that because The Miracles and I were gone 90% of the time, 80% of the time we were gone. So I was afraid that my kids wouldn't know me. And I had waited so long for them. And I didn't want them not to know me. And I wanted to be there when they said their first words and when they took their first steps and all that. You know, I wanted to see that because we tried so hard. And so I was more concerned about my kids not knowing me and not feeling, okay, here's dad, you know, rather than I come in the house and say, oh, can I have your autograph or something, you know what I mean? So, but anyway, I tried the retirement. It just did not work for me. And like I said, I can't find anything that fulfills me. Like doing concerts and recording and doing the things that I do pertaining to entertaining.
I mean, you never stopped not just performing, but writing songs. Like, you wrote a volume of songs that can't come from the kind of person who's waiting for inspiration to strike. You wrote songs like it was your job, because it was. And that's not something everybody can do. Like, not everybody can sit down and be like, all right, circus. I'm going to write a circus song. You know what I mean? And then write a truly great song. You know what I mean?
But it's my love. It's my love. I write all the time. And I'm a firm believer that God gives everybody gifts. Everybody. I don't care what your conditions are, whatever. You got a gift. And some people never discover their gifts. Some people never pursue them. Some people find them and squander them. Some people do it. But everybody gets one. And I think that one of the gifts that he gave me was to write songs, because I'm not a songwriter who needs to isolate myself or go away for 2 or 3 months and so I can just write and do that like that, you know. And I don't function like that. You could say something during this interview that might trigger something in me to write a song, man, because that's how it happens for me. I can be, you know, in my car and see a billboard or read something in the paper or online or something, you know, that triggers something in me that wants to write a song about that. So I I've always been that way. I don't need certain conditions to write, or and people ask me that. Well, what comes first, the words or the music? Yes.
I mean, when you were a kid, you were a songwriting nerd.
Yeah.
Which is like a pretty unusual way to follow the music industry when you're 10 years old.
Yeah.
Or whatever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like looking at liner notes, mm-hmm. and what have you.
Yeah, I wrote my first song that anybody ever heard other than my mom and me when I was 6 for a school play. And so I've been trying to write poems and songs and all my life that I can remember. It's just a part of me is what I do. And like I said, I can't find anything that I love more than this.
What songs did you admire when you were a kid?
Oh, man, are you kidding me?
I mean, like, not just records, but songs.
Well, see, I'm a person, I was very blessed, man. I grew up in a home where there was always music. I mean, of every kind. I had a great dose of music growing up because my mom played the blues. I mean, the Gut Bucket Blues, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, Little Walter, you know, people like that, John Lee Hooker. And then someday she played the Five Blind Boys and the Volunteers and the Ward Singers and people with gospel. And then some days, for 2 or 3 days in a row, my mom would just listen to Beethoven and Bach and Chopin and people like that. So I was hearing that. Then I had 2 older sisters. My youngest sister was 14 when I was born. So they were way older than me, you know what I mean? And they played Dizzy Gillespie and Count Basie and Duke Ellington and Patti Page and Sarah Vaughan and Frank Sinatra and people like that, you know? So they had their music, and they played some music like Dizzy Gillespie, they call that bebop, and they played that. So I heard every kind of music you can think of.
And there must have been a lot of doo-wop and stuff on the street as well.
Well, there was. I was about to get to that. When I got old enough, when I was like 10 or whatever, and I decided that I would have my own people that I was a fan of, you know, and I wanted to buy my own records and people like that. I mean, things like that. Okay, Jackie Wilson was my number one singing idol. Sam Cooke, Ray Charles, Frankie Lyman, Nolan Strong. These were the guys that I loved and I listened to, and I bought their music and I emulated them trying to sing, you know what I mean? So I've always had a great love and a great dose of music.
Let's talk about Jackie Wilson for a second.
Okay.
I've heard you talk about Jackie Wilson before.
Mm-hmm.
And you do not sing like Jackie Wilson.
No. No one did.
That's fair, right? So, yeah. Like, Jackie Wilson really changed the way people sang. You know, Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson in particular really mm-hmm. changed the way people sang.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Wilson was a big performer.
Yes.
Did you want to just rip it like Jackie Wilson could?
Of course I did. I would have walked 10 miles to see Jackie Wilson perform, man. Jackie was, you know, I tell everybody, Michael Jackson. When I first met Michael Jackson, he was 10 years old. He came to Barry's house with his brothers, and he came to do the audition before they were signed to Motown. And Michael Jackson, when after I saw him, I called him Jackie Brown because he was a cross between Jackie Wilson and James Brown. And I mean, he had them down pat. He was 10 years old. He was kicking butt. You know what I mean? He was just dynamic, but he was a cross between Jackie Wilson and James Brown. So Jackie Wilson was dynamic. You know, Jackie Wilson was one of those performers, man. You go see Jackie Wilson, and as soon as he come out on stage, he don't even have to say a word, and chicks were falling out. You know? So he was that kind of performer, and he was a great entertainer. So, I loved him, and he was a great example of what I thought a guy in show business should be.
Did you think that you should go out on stage and scream and do the splits? Because that's not what your career ended up being, right?
No. I didn't necessarily think I should scream because I've always been a soft singer. So I didn't necessarily think I should scream, but I did wish that I could do the splits and all that. I'm not a dancer. You know what I mean? In fact, we had a choreographer at Motown at our artist development school, and his name was Charlie Atkins. And Charlie had been a vaudeville dancer with a guy who ran the Apollo Theater, a guy named Honey Coles. And they were vaudeville dancers, Coles and Atkins, you know. But he came to be our choreographer at Motown. And he used to tell me when we went to rehearsal, boy, I'm so glad you're the lead singer so I don't have to try to show you these steps because you cannot do it. So I'm not a dancer. So I knew. And another inspiration for me as far as being on stage was when I first saw Frankie Lymon and the Teenagers. Now, they were more inspiration for me than anybody I'd ever seen up to that point, including Jackie Wilson, because they were my age. You know, I went to see them. There was a theater in Detroit where the talent came to called the Broadway Capitol. They were playing at the Broadway Capitol, and I go see them. And here, I'm like 14, you know, and they come out on stage, and they're 14, 15, and like that. And I'm watching them, and they were dynamic, and they were doing the splits and bouncing each other off their heads, and, you know. So that made me think I'd like to do that, but I just don't have the dancing skills to pull that off.
Did you think that you could be a singer as great as those great singers that you admired, or were you thinking, I'm going to write songs my way into this? You know what I mean?
No, I was just thinking, can we make a record? We just wanted to make a record. You know, just we make a record and be on the radio and that stuff like that. I wasn't thinking about being in competition with Sam or Jackie or Frankie or Ray or anything. I wasn't thinking about being in competition with them. You know, I just want to make a record.
Because there was, I read this piece that my producers, bless them, dug up for me that was an ancient Robert Christgau piece about you from the, like, I don't know, it seemed like it was around 1970, 1975. And he used a word, he's not always dead on about soul and R&B, he was a rock guy, but like he used a word that I thought was really telling and insightful, which was he described your performances as modest.
Ah.
And not modest in a diminishing way, mm-hmm. Not like modest as opposed to great, but there is always a reserve in the way that you sing. There is always a sort of like personal, almost like conversational quality to your performances, even in a song that's big, like Tears of a Clown, that's huge feelings. Like there's that kind of almost like a casual intimacy. You know what I mean? And that's a different thing from those people that you're talking about, even Sam Cooke.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate that because it gives me an identity. See, I'm glad that I have my own identity. I'm glad that I have my own, whatever it is that is my own, as far as being a singer. I don't necessarily, especially at this point in my life or for many, 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 many years, I wasn't trying to emulate any of those singers after I became professional.
You met Berry Gordy auditioning for Jackie Wilson's management, right?
Yes.
So what was he doing there?
Berry, when I met him, man, he was just a songwriter and a record producer. He had written all of the hit songs for Jackie Wilson up to that point. And that day, I tell everybody it was a God day because it was, because he didn't have to be there the day that we went to audition, but he was. And we didn't have to go on the day when he was there, but we were. And he was there because he had some new songs for Jackie. Among them was Lonely Teardrops. So he was there. He was just going to wait till we got through. And I thought he was waiting to audition because he looked so young. Like I was 16 and Barry looked like he was no more than 18 or 19. You know, he was 10 years older than me, but he looked like he was 18 or 19. I thought he was waiting to audition, you know. And he's just sitting there listening. And so he liked a couple of my songs because we sang five songs that I had written rather than some songs that were currently popular. Thinking that it would be an asset, thinking that they would say, oh, these kids got their own material. Yeah, we love them. We'll sign them. But they didn't like us at all because we were like the Platters. You know, the Platters were the number one group in the world at that time. And they had Zola Taylor, who was the girl in the group. We had a girl in our group. And Tony sang high and I sang high. And they told us, they said, you guys will never make it. You know, because we already got the Platters. We don't need another Platters. So you'll never make it. That's what they told us. We can't use you. Meantime, Barry's sitting there and he heard a couple of my songs that we sang that he liked. And he came out after. We walked out of there dejected and stopped us. And he and I struck up a conversation. He wanted to know where we got the songs from. And I told him I'd written them. And he said, you got any more songs? He shouldn't have said that because I had a loose leaf notebook with 100 songs in it about, man.
Did you have that Big Ten notebook like in your
hand?
I sure did.
Sure did, man. I carried it everywhere.
Do you still have it?
No, man. Are you kidding me? See, that's one of the things when people say, do you have any regrets? Yeah, I regret that I don't have that book because that would be invaluable right now. You know, all the scrub songs and stuff like that that I had in there that didn't make sense until Barry started to mentor me into writing songs and so on and so on, made them coordinate within themselves. But yeah, I wish I had that. There's another regret that I have as far as keeping stuff like that is the fact that when we first started Motown, we had been in business for probably about maybe a year or so like that. And there were places in Detroit, whereas if you were black, you didn't go to those places. You didn't go to Dearborn. You didn't go to Grosse Pointe. You didn't go to Broomfield Hills. You didn't go to those places like that if you were black, unless you had something on you that said you worked for somebody over there. Because if police saw you over there, they were going to either arrest you or whoop your you know, just for being black, you know. We started to get letters from the white kids in those areas. We got your music. We love your music. Our parents don't know that we have it, though, because if they did, they might make us throw it away. So we won't tell them, but we got them. Those letters would be priceless at this point. We didn't think the same because we were young. We would just move around. Oh, this is great. We're getting these letters and just put them on the desk. We all know what happened to them. You know what I mean? A year or so after that, we get letters from the parents. We found out our kids would listen to your music. We were curious to see what they were listening to. We love your music. We're glad they had it. Blah, blah, blah. You could not put a price on those. You couldn't, you know? So, yeah, I wish that I had kept some of that stuff, that notebook with those songs in it and so on. I wish that I had kept that. But once you start moving along and you're finally doing what your wildest, most impossible dream is, because I never dared to dream that I would actually be in show business for real. I grew up in the hood, and I grew up where there were 1,000 singers, you know, and we used to have group battles and things like that. I never thought I'd be one of the ones who would come out of that and have a career in show business. I was afraid to think that, you know, but I did, and I was blessed to get that, you know, so I cherish it.
I want to ask you about you and Barry Gordy in the beginning. You mentioned that he mentored you. The thing that ties all the great Motown records together to my ear, the ones that you wrote, you know, there were a number of amazing hit writing, songwriting groups at Motown. The thing that ties them all together is this kind of plain clarity. Like each song is an idea distilled. And I get the impression that that is the thing that Barry Gordy brought to you, that he said, look, you're talented. Let's figure out how to focus these songs, distill these songs to the simplest thing, the clearest thing that means something.
Well, yeah, he did. What he did with me was to make me realize that a song is a complete idea within itself. When I first met Barry, we sang two songs at that audition, and one of them turned out to be the flip side of our very first record. It was a song called My Mama Done Told Me, and it was intact. You know what I mean? most of my songs at that time, from like I said, from the time I was 4 and 5 years old, I could write poems and I could rhyme stuff. I'll give you an example. My first verse is, "Oh, my darling, I love you so much. I'm so glad we're here together. I'm holding you. There's nothing like being here with you, and we should always be like this." Be all rhymed up, okay? Second verse. "Oh, baby, when are you coming back? I haven't seen you in 10 years. I miss you so much. I want you to be with me, blah, 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 blah." But it's all rhymed up. Not, it had nothing to do with the first verse, you know what I'm saying? So finally, after I've sung about 20 songs to Barry that day, he said, "Hey, man," he said, "let me tell you something." He said, "A song has got to be a short book or a short movie or a short play or something that the beginning and the middle and the ending tie in together with one idea and one purpose. Go home, listen to the radio, see what they're writing." And I'd been listening to Gershwin and Chopin and Cohen and people like that all my life, because like I said, I grew up in a house where all those people were being played. And they were songwriters. They were songwriters, man. To show you how much they were songwriters, their music is just as popular today as it was when it originally came out. They were songwriters. So that's what I want to be. I want to write a song that if I had written it 50 years before now, it would have meant something. Today, it's going to mean something. 50 years from now, it's going to mean something. I tell people all the time, I want to be like Beethoven, man. They're still playing Beethoven's music after 500 years, you know? So if I can, I'd like to accomplish that.
I want to give you an example, right? So you co-wrote The Way You Do the Things You Do, which is one of the great pop records of the century. Like a,
thank you.
You know, it's like a perfect song, right? And there's this story, and it's probably apocryphal. I don't know if it is or not. I don't know how real it is. That like when that song got handed in and the temps got it in their hand, they were like, "Wow, Love So Bright You Could Have Been a Candle. This is too stupid to record."
That's what Otis felt. Oh, you know, Otis is the founder of that group. Otis and I just talked about that about a month ago, but that's how he felt.
But what I mean by bringing that up is that, you know, there is no like trying to be cute and clever in that. It is so straightforward and so clear, and its beauty comes from that kind of simplicity, that kind of clarity.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, because my thoughts on The Way You Do the Things You Do, I actually started writing that in the car. I was driving the car. It was my turn to drive, and we were on our way back to Detroit after we had been on a tour. And everyone was asleep, and I was thinking about the Temptations because I had talked to them before we left town, and they were saying, "Well, we're never going to get a hit and all that, you know, and Barry's going to fire us and other." And I told them, no, once you sign with Motown, man, we work with you till you can get a hit if possible. But anyway, and so we're on the way back home, and I'm thinking about them. And I had a nickname for them. I used to call them the Five Deacons, because this area that we're in right now, if I had brought David and Eddie and Paul and Melvin and Otis in this room right here and said, "Hey, man, sing Ooh," and they said, "Ooh," they would have shook this room. That's how tight their harmony was. And how gospel it sounded, you know what I mean? So I said, I want to write something for them where they can display that part of themselves. So that's why I wrote The Way You Do Things You Do, because it had, "You got a smile so bright," and you're singing all that together, you know, for that reason. And I wanted it to be ear-catching. Like you asked me about gasms, you know, earlier. I wanted it to be ear-catching. So it was sort of like a little fancy. "You got a smile so bright, you know, you could have been a candle." But that's ear-catching. And what do you mean? What is he saying? What do you mean? So that's what I wanted it to be. And at the time, we used to have contests at Motown for records. Every Monday morning, we had a meeting in Barry's office that started at 9 o'clock. If you got there at 9:01, you're locked out. And all of the creative people were there. No salespeople, no anybody else, just the writers and the producers. And if you had a song and you had written it, say, for the Supremes, and they liked it, you were free to record it on them, okay? It didn't matter that Holland Dozier Holland had the last 5 number one records on them. If you had a song and they liked it, you could record it on them, okay? And then you bring it to the meeting, and we sat there and critiqued each other's music to make it better. We're all competing against each other now, but when you hear somebody's music, you say, oh, man, if you had done so-and-so and so-and-so, that would have been much better. I'll give you an example. Tracks of My Tears. I take the Tracks of My Tears to the meeting. I've just finished completing the recording and stuff like that. I take it to the meeting. There's a passage in the Tracks of My Tears in between. It's sort of like a lead-in between the verses. I need you, need you, need you. So now I take it in, and I have ended the record with that. I need you, need you, need you. And everybody listened to it. And when it got through playing, Barry and Brian Holland of Holland Dozier Holland said, man, what are you doing? I said, well, what do you mean? What am I doing? I said, you think that's a hit? It could be, but what are you doing? I said, what are you talking about? What am I doing? They said, you got one of the best choruses in the world. Take a good look at my face. And you're going to end the song with, I need you, rather than with that chorus. Go back. End it with the chorus. So I did. I went back and re-recorded it and ended it with the chorus. But that's what we did at those meetings. Brian Holland had some music that he wanted to do. Barry had some, you know. But we helped each other. Even though we were in competition with each other, we still critiqued positively everyone's music. So take a good look at my face. You'll see my smile looks out of place. If you look closer, it's easy to trace the tracks of my tears.
I want to ask you about one of my favorite, in fact, I might even say my favorite of your solo songs. And it's one from, you know, your solo career had periods where you were really trying to figure out how to reach audiences.
Yeah.
And this was from one of them. It was from before Quiet Storm. It's a song that you wrote with your sister called Virgin Man that was a single. And, like, I was thinking of it because of the level of horniness in your new record. But it also very sincerely is, like, one of my favorite songs of yours of
Thank
all
you.
Time. And I want to play a little bit of it for the audience who might not be familiar with it. In your well into your 30s when you wrote and recorded this song, stakes were relatively high for your solo career, right? You didn't know Quiet Storm was coming down the road and that you were about to, you know, have a revival and invent an entire new genre of music. But, like, this is a weird song to have written and released as a single, Smokey. Yeah. And again, I love this song.
Thank you. At the time I wrote Virgin Man, though, man, I wasn't back in show business. I wrote that because at the time I retired, and I retired with the thought in my mind to never, ever be on stage again, to never, ever go into the studio and record a song on myself. I was going to write for some other people and produce some other records and stuff like that, maybe, but I was just going to be the vice president and do what I did and blah, blah, blah. And I wasn't going to be on the outer edges of show business ever again. So in retiring from the Miracles, I wrote a song called Sweet Harmony. And I wrote that to the Miracles. I didn't intend for anyone in the world to hear that except the Miracles. I was going to make a copy for each one of them and give it to them as a keepsake. The song says, Sweet Harmony, go on and blow on. Even though I'm not there, you can make it. Because you're just that talented. You don't need me to make it. So go on, you got a great career still ahead of you, and so on and so forth. That's what the song is about.
Make the world aware that you're still going strong. Gone. Spread your joy around the world. Spread your joy around the world. Sweet.
So I'm going to record it and give the Miracles each their copy.
Just because you love them.
Just because I love them, okay. So I did, and Suzanne DePass, who was one of our top people at Motown, she was our A&R director at the time, and she heard it. And she said, Smoke, she said, the world should hear this song. I said, no, babe. I said, I just want the Miracles to hear it. It's just a thing. I'm out of show business. I don't want to. She said, no, man. She said, the world should know that you feel like this about the Miracles. The world should hear this. Because most groups break up negatively. Something's going to happen negative, and they, you know. And she said, the world should know that you feel like this, and this, the world should hear this. So I kept saying it, but she finally convinced me. So I said, oh, okay, go ahead, release it. So she releases it, and she comes back to me about a week later and says, you know, we need an album to go with this record. Because albums are what's happening now, you know. I said, an album? She said, yeah. I said, I told you I'm not doing it. Anyway, she convinced me I made an album. And on that album, my guitarist, who is passed on now, a guy named Marv Tarplin, who was the source of so many songs for me, so many popular songs for me, he was still with the Miracles, and he called me. And he said, hey, man, he said, I'm leaving the group. He said, I want to come out to Los Angeles and be with you, and let's just write some songs. I said, okay, cool. So in the meantime, he and his girlfriend had started this song called Baby Come Close. He bought that, and he let me hear it. It was so beautiful. And I took it, and I finished it up and wrote some words, and I recorded it. And so we put the album out, and it becomes like a mild hit. I'm not looking to get a hit. I don't even want that. You know what I'm saying? But here it is, you know. So that was the reason that I recorded those albums that had Virgin Man on it.
We have to go to a quick break. More with Smokey Robinson when we come back. Don't go anywhere. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Charles Schwab with their original podcast, Choiceology. Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind people's decisions. Download the latest episode and subscribe at schwab.com/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you keep your stress bottled up, it can eat away at you. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to make them better. Try BetterHelp Online Therapy, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp at betterhelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month.
Support for NPR and the following message come from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. International travel can be life-changing, but an unexpected emergency can make your trip memorable for all the wrong reasons. Allianz Travel Insurance provides benefits for medical emergencies, trip cancellations, travel delays, and more. Get a quote at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Are you tired of being picked on for only wanting to talk about your cat at parties?
Do you feel as though your friends don't understand the depth of love you have for your guinea pig?
When you look around a room of people, do you wonder if they know sloths only have to eat one leaf a month?
Have you ever dumped someone for saying they're just not an animal person?
Us too.
She's Alexis B. Preston.
She's Ella McLeod.
And we host Comfort Creatures, the show where you can't talk about your pets too much. Animal trivia is our love language. And dragons are just as real as dinosaurs.
Tune in to Comfort Creatures every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Smokey Robinson, the legendary Motown singer-songwriter and producer. He's created dozens of chart-topping hits. He has a new solo album out called Gasms. Let's get back into our conversation. Look, I'm going to go ahead and stipulate that you're a very good-looking man, famously good-looking man. You don't have to say anything about that. You don't have to say anything about
it.
I'm just letting you know, okay, right? And you have been a hit maker for a long time. You very well could have just been cutting records about how, look, maybe, if not macho, like you weren't going to sing any songs about beating anybody up, but like how you were the king of love or something. You know what I mean? And you've written so many love songs, and so often they are about being a little scared, being lonely, like being worried. That is the kind of modesty that I was talking about, right? There is always like a little bit of reserve. It's not even like, you know, you were tight with Marvin Gaye. When Marvin Gaye sings a love song, it's about that, like being enveloped in this sensuality and, you know, you're tied in to Marvin, right? Mm-hmm. Yours are always about sort of asking a little bit, you know what I mean? Like being there and saying that kind of connection.
Well, love to me is, it's the greatest subject. It's the most powerful emotion that we can possibly experience. Love is the ruler. You see, even people, I'll use bigotry as an example of this. People who are bigots, they hate other people because they call themselves being protective of those that they love. I'm going to protect my race. I love my race. I'm going to protect my race. I love my people like me and so on and so. Love trumps hate every time. See, and so love is the most powerful emotion that we can experience. And if I'm going to write, I want to be in the ballpark with something that's going to be interesting to people. And love is whatever face it has, however it presents itself, it's still powerful. It's probably the most hurting thing you could feel and the most joyful thing that you could feel. It covers the gamut of emotion, and it is the most powerful one that we could possibly experience, as far as I'm concerned, as people, because it just trumps everything. You know, you love somebody, and people say, you know, well, you shouldn't love that person. If there was a button, nobody would ever love anybody, because you wouldn't want to take that chance. You don't want to get your heart broken or your feelings hurt or any of that, you know. So I just keep them to myself, just be with this person, but I don't love them. So, but love makes you do foolish things, you know. So it's just all powerful, and I like presenting that if I can, because like I said, it has any face you can think of. Sadness, happiness, hurt, joy. It covers all that.
And you in your life have had experience really, not just with love, but with really messing up love. I mean, like you have, one of your kids was with someone who wasn't your wife. Your wife ended up, your first wife, Claudette, ended up breaking up with you, or the two of you broke up.
Yeah.
You know, there was a period in your life where you were using so much that you basically messed up your relationships with everybody in your life.
Yeah. Especially me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like love has been a smooth and easy thing for you.
No, I don't think it's been a smooth and easy thing for anybody who falls in love. Well, anybody who loves anything or anybody, it's not a smooth, you know, it's not smooth going. Like I said, and I think if it is, if it's just, you're just smooth and everything is all right all the time, you're not in love, you know. Because when you're in love, you know, you care about that person. You care about what they're doing or saying or being or any of that. And nobody's perfect. So you have to go through all that in order to withstand love, in order to cope with it, in order to cope with the person that you love or have them cope with you. You have to experience some negativity involved in it, because it's not going to be smooth if you're really in love, you know. Now, it can get overbearing, and you can kill love. And especially with women, you know, a woman can take a man who is a derelict. She can go down on Skid Row and see a dude and something about him that she likes, and he's hasn't bathed in 2 months, and he's scruffy and homeless and all that, and derelict, and she'll take him home clean him up because she loves him, and she'll clean him up and be with him and love him. And then he can get to the point where he is the CEO of IBM, and she don't love him no more. It's over. It is over, okay? So love is like that.
Did that happen to you in your life?
Not exactly like that. You know, I think that I was the one who screwed up more so than, you know, Claudette. I know I was, and I searched myself to find out why, because she's only been loving to me for my whole life, still today. Like I said, today's her birthday, and, you know, I'm married to somebody else now, but we still have a great relationship, you know. But I screwed up with her because I was young. Gosh, I married her when I was 19. I thought I was a man. I'm a man. I'm gonna get married because she's in the group. We're traveling. I'm a man. I'm 19. You know, that's a joke. I wish one of my kids would have come to me when they were 19, talking about getting married. That's a joke, you know. But I did, and she was my girlfriend from the time I was 14 years old. You know what I mean? So when I started, you know, getting out into the world and all that, I just guess I was too young to cope with it or to know how to deal with it. And so I screwed up. And I admit it, you know. But, you know, that's love.
When you were using coke in the 80s, I mean, you got pretty close to the story that you told just now, the theoretical story that you just told right now about somebody getting found on the street by somebody. You know, 5 years ago, maybe Charlie Wilson was in here, a great singer.
Yes.
And Charlie Wilson was very literally living on the street for
a few
Charlie's
years. My brother. I know that, man. I know, you know, I've been following Charlie, man, since the Gap Band.
Right. And, yeah. You know, his wife, you know, works very, they're very, very much partners.
Yes.
Like, that was their story.
That was their story. Absolutely.
And, you know, I couldn't, when I was reading about you using in the late 70s, early 80s, like, I couldn't help but notice that parallel. I thought, Smokey did not end up that far from that situation. Like, if he hadn't gotten dragged to church one day, that could happen to Smokey Robinson.
It could happen to me, or I could be dead. Yeah, because I was strung out, and I never... drugs are so sneaky, and they're so unassuming. You know, it's like people, especially people who consider themselves to be too strong, like I did. I'm ego tripping. I'm too strong for this. This will never happen to me. That kind of stuff, you know.
And you were like a grown adult. Like, it's not like you had been using for decades.
You know what I mean, man?
You were a grown adult who started as a grown adult it got out of control really fast.
Absolutely. And that's what I tell people all the time about it, because I speak everywhere now. I speak at churches, rehabs, and gang meetings and schools and everywhere. And I talk about the drug thing, man, because people think that, you know, drugs are something that, you know, you just take, for instance, people who say, well, you know, they come to the schools and they're giving drugs to our kids. And so our kids are not stupid, you know, like some strangers are going to come to them and say, hey, kid, try this. And they're going to say, yeah. You start doing drugs with your friends, with the people you love, who love you. You start because you trust them and they trust you. So you're passing these drugs back and forth and you start with them. You don't start doing drugs with a stranger just comes up from nowhere and stuff like, and people have a mythical thing about that. Well, you know, if this person hadn't come along, no. You start with your best friend, with people that you've known all your life. You start with people you trust, you know, and that's how sneaky drugs are. And if you open that door, they're going to come in.
You're Smokey Robinson, Smokey, which means your public persona is, you know, if people think of Smokey Robinson, they think about the sweetness of your singing. They think about the sweetness of your songs, the coolness of, you know, Quiet Storm. They think about the relaxation of cruising. You know what I mean? These feelings of kind of gentle love. But that could be a lot to carry as an actual human being. Do you feel pressured to be that in the world?
No, man, I really don't. Yeah. See, I think that when you flow naturally, I just flow like that, man. I you know, I'm a people lover. And I just flow like that. I don't have to pretend or it's a burden for me to be who I am or anything like that. I just am who I am, and I've been this person all my life.
Do you remember the campaign song that you wrote for your friend Naomi, who ran for class president?
Mm-hmm.
How did the song go?
Well, I was in junior high at the time, and it only went to the ninth grade. And it said, hey, 9A's, I say that today is election day. And I hope, feel something, and I pray that you vote for Naomi, because Naomi was our girl who was running from our class, you know. So, yeah. And Aretha Franklin's brother, Cecil, and a guy named Floyd, and a guy named Michael Fitzgerald. We had a group in junior high school, and we sang it, and she won. So, yeah.
Smokey, I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you for coming here.
Thank you very much.
I
really appreciate
you. It's a real honor to get
to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Smokey Robinson, folks, his new album is called Gasms. Let's go out on one more song from that record. This is Beside You.
Beside you. That's where I want to be. Forever, I'm like a soul lost in the river, searching for a helping hand.
That's the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is created from the homes of me and the staff of Maximum Fun in and around Greater Los Angeles, California. Here in my home, I have been thinking about the great Sinead O'Connor, who was a staple in my home growing up. I have an Irish stepmother and a father who loved soul music, and the intersection of those things was the courageous and incredible Sinead O'Connor. And look, so many people have said so many things about her. I only wish I ever could have had her on this show. We tried many times. And there just have been none greater than Sinead O'Connor. An absolute hero to me. And I'm so happy that she's been so deeply appreciated, even if it is in the wake of the tragedy of her passing. Our show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Our producers are Jesus Ambrosio and Richard Roby. Our production fellow at Maximum Fun is Brianna Paz. We get booking help from Mara Davis. Our interstitial music is composed and provided to us by the great Dan Wally, DJW. Our theme song is by The Go Team. It's called Huddle Formation. Our thanks to The Go Team. Our thanks to their label Memphis Industries. Our special thanks this week to NPR's Standards and Practices Managing Editor, Tony Cavan, for confirming that we can say the title of Smokey Robinson's latest album here on NPR without bleeping it. That might sound sarcastic, but I am so sincerely grateful for the folks who handle Standards and Practices at NPR. It is always fun and delightful to bring them a conundrum like that one, and they're always so great. Just know there's good folks looking out for your ears at NPR. You can find this week's show on YouTube, on Twitter, and on Facebook, where we share all of our interviews. Tell somebody about it if you liked it. Or if you heard part of it, you listen on the radio, you didn't hear all of it. Go to NPR.org or MaximumFun.org, search for Smokey Robinson, or just find it on YouTube and share it that way. I think that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
Yes, beside you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Allianz Travel Insurance. Don't get caught without emergency medical coverage on an international trip. Learn how Allianz Travel Insurance can protect your trip from the unexpected at AllianzTravelInsurance.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Learning. IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. Get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.